Academy at West Point, and other members of Task Force Ranger have found that their losses and sacrifices are no longer completely forgotten. Kenny Thomas has formed a band whose most recent CD, Headspace and Timing, terms familiar to Ranger gunners, is dedicated to the men of Task Force Ranger. "Through your work, you have helped to tell our story," he wrote in a letter shortly before the book came out. "You have given people an understanding. You have given me, in a sense, validity. Validity to say, this is what I did, and it is important you know about it. This is what I did, and I can be proud of that. I need not feel guilty anymore. The solutions to my healing process have begun, thanks mostly to you. And that, my friend, is why I thank you." This sentiment, expressed so many times through official and unofficial military channels, has been the biggest and most pleasant surprise to me since the book was published. Black Hawk Down is hardly the version of this battle that would have been produced by some arm of military public relations. It tells of miscalculations and embarrassing inter-unit squabbling. It offers at least a glimpse of the Somali point of view during the fighting, and of alarmingly ill-considered United Nations and U.S. actions that led up to this battle. It reveals simple blunders, like failing to take sufficient water and night vision devices on the raid, and soldiers leaving armored plates out of their bulletproof vests and wearing little plastic hockey helmets instead of the heavy Kevlar helmets that are standard issue. It deals unblinkingly with the horrors of combat, with death and dismemberment, with fear and indecision. There are plenty of instances of hesitation, second thoughts, and even callous actions by American soldiers. It reveals details of the battle that the Army still regards as classified, not least of which is the role played by its top-secret Delta Force unit. If you had asked me before Black Hawk Down was published, I would have predicted an angry response from the military, even though I knew the book accurately reflected the experiences of the men who fought there. Instead, the military has embraced Black Hawk Down. It is now one of the mandatory books on the curriculum of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where I have received 3 separate invitations to speak. The book has received several honors from the U.S. Marine Corps and has been personally recommended by the Corps Commandant. I have lectured twice at Central Intelligence Agency headquarters, as well as at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where I was invited to dine with the cadets as a guest of honor, and have signed books at the Pentagon Mall bookstore before being taken off for a personal meeting with U.S. Army Secretary Luis Caldera. I have received personal notes of thanks from General Henry Shelton, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Anthony Zinni, USMC, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Central Command. President Bill Clinton even sent me a handwritten note thanking me for writing it. I am deeply flattered and grateful for all these things, and still surprised. One reason for the resonance of Black Hawk Down is that it illustrates a central problem of our time. One of the many kind reviews I have received about the book concluded by calling it an adventurous look at the predicament of being an American at the turn of the century. I think that's right. It is too easy to dismiss what happened in Mogadishu as the work of incompetent politicians, diplomats, and generals. You can't just blame President Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Les Aspin, or General Garrison. The policy that led Task Force Ranger to Somalia in the summer of 1993 was the result of America's new and uncomfortable role in the world. President Bush committed the United States to the mission, and the decision to nation-build, once the famine ended, was the perfectly logical outgrowth of that policy. The famine in Somalia had not been caused by a natural disaster. It was man-made, a result of cynical, feuding warlords deliberately using starvation as a weapon. It would not have made much sense to simply walk away after delivering food for a few weeks or months and allow the crisis to renew. There were those, they seem prescient in retrospect, who argued that there are limits to what America can accomplish. And if the United States erred in overreaching, it was for laudable reasons. Our intervention begged the central issue. As the world's only military superpower, should we stand by and let terrible human tragedies unfold? Aren't we morally obligated to do something? And in this age of instant global communication, there isn't much that happens in the world that Americans don't witness in color in our living rooms. The decision to go after Mohammed Farah Aidid was not some foolhardy adventure in Clintonian nation-building, although there certainly was some overreaching involved. Its primary advocate was Admiral Jonathan Howe, a former member of Bush's National Security Council, who was then the United Nations' top man in Somalia. Howe was rightfully indignant when Aidid's militias began attacking and killing the UN peacekeepers he supervised. If Aidid was responsible for the deaths of 24 Pakistani soldiers on June 24, 1993, as he appears to have been, he deserved to be branded an outlaw. Bringing him to justice was a worthy cause, and Howe was precisely the person who ought to have been forcefully advocating it. None of the steps that led us to the Battle of Mogadishu were wild departures from the normal course of post-Cold War foreign policy. The battle came at the end of a chain of eminently defensible decisions, made carefully by sensible people. The same could be said of the military decisions. Task Force Ranger was dispatched to Mogadishu reluctantly, but if the United States was serious about going after Aidid, then Delta Force and the Rangers were the best-trained men for the job. To dismiss the incident as a blunder, and those who were responsible as fools, assumes that different leaders would have seen things more clearly and known better what to do. The foreign policy lesson I take from this story is like the old prayer. Lord, grant me the strength to change the things I can, to accept the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. Learning what America's power can and can't accomplish is a major challenge in the post-Cold War world. The answers are not easy. Still, everywhere I've gone, people have asked me for answers. Mine are no better or more significant than those of anyone who has studied this incident and thought seriously about it. But here they are. I believe it would have been hard for the United States not to go after Aidid, but it would have been better not to try. Ending a famine was a good deed, one that Americans can take pride in, and making efforts to resolve the inter-clan fighting in Somalia through negotiation was advisable and admirable. But Aidid's hard line forced the Clinton administration to take sides in what was nothing more than a civil war. We should have said no. Once a peacekeeping force starts shooting, it becomes part of the problem. Arresting Aidid would most likely have just given the Habergideh leader a more fervently motivated following and would have elevated a two-bit Somali warlord to the status of an anti-imperialist hero in many parts of the world. I acknowledge that it would not have been easy to back away from this fight with Aidid. If the United States and the UN had tried to simply phase out their involvement in Somalia, critics all over the world would have accused Americans of leaving an important humanitarian task undone. And they would have been right. That said, once we committed ourselves to the effort, I believe the United States should have seen the mission through, even after the battle on October 3rd, especially after the battle. There was every indication that Aidid was on the ropes. This story would have had a much more satisfying ending if he had been delivered up in chains, and ironically, if he had, he would probably still be alive today. Arguing in favor of the decision to withdraw was the memory of Vietnam, where the generals felt victory was always within reach, so long as the country kept notching up its commitment. The American public and its elected officials were led down a primrose path in that war, and the nation paid a terrible price. In Somalia, the chances of success were far greater and more tangible because the mission was so limited. There was little danger of American troops being drawn into a quagmire in Somalia. No matter what ultimate impact Idid's arrest would have had on the UN's goals in Somalia, it was important to see the mission through once Task Force Ranger was committed. The lesson our retreat taught the world's terrorists and despots is that killing a few American soldiers, even at a cost of more than 500 of your own fighters, is enough to spook Uncle Sam. Perhaps more important, however, is the lesson it sent to Americans, and in particular, the men and women who serve. It's hard enough convincing Americans that events in some distant part of the world are worth jeopardizing American lives without being half-hearted about intervention. Try rallying troops with the battle cry, "We'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the cliffs, but we'll give up if they fight back." Military credibility is not just a matter of national pride. It lessens the chances of war because enemies are less inclined to challenge America. This principle is especially important in a world with only one military superpower. The 800-pound gorilla's only weakness is his will. Routing Idid would have, in the long run, saved American lives. It is easy, of course, to say that now. President Clinton would have faced a rebellion in Congress and a firestorm of criticism in the press if he had attempted to stay the course in October 1993. Beyond these policy issues, I attribute the military's warm response and the book's larger success to something else. Thanks to the exceptional candor of the men whose stories make up Black Hawk Down, what comes through most strongly is their determination, their willingness to put themselves at risk, indeed to die, in service of their country, and out of loyalty to their fellows. Beyond the politics of the situation, beyond the critical debate over strategy and tactics, the story of what happened in Mogadishu resonates with the nobility of military service. Nobility is not a word often associated with the military these days. For the last three decades, most of the stories about soldiers that have made their way into popular culture have been about atrocities, failures, and scandals. From My Lai to Desert One to Tail Hook. The public image of the military is of a vast, impersonal, callous, dangerous, and often inept bureaucracy. Even when victorious, as in the Persian Gulf, Panama, and Grenada, the U.S. military is seen as just bigger, richer, and more powerful than the army of any other nation. America is often perceived as the world's bully. Black Hawk Down is a reminder that the seemingly inhuman machine of the American military is made up of individual men and women, often serving at great personal sacrifice, even when not thrust into war. The men of Task Force Ranger gave more than will ever be asked of most of us. They deserve to be honored and remembered. Mark Bowden, November 1999.
That was Black Hawk Down by Mark Bowden, read by Alan Sklar.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.